I mean, like famously, Aquinas is like, we can't prove the Trinity from reason alone. And it seems like Scotus is like, yeah, I agree. But here's some triple primacy stuff. And then he's like, well, divine love unites them all. Yeah. Right. So it's like, well, is this an argument for the Trinity? Like, what
no.
Is,
okay. No.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setecase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is another very special one. I have with me a very special guest. I believe it's his third time on the podcast. I'm going to be talking with Dr. Tom Ward, and we're going to be talking about his new book on John Duns Scotus called Ordered by Love, An Introduction to John Scotus. It's awesome. If you guys don't know about Scotus, you're in for a treat. If you do know about Scotus, you're in for a treat and maybe a good old-fashioned triggering if you're hardcore Thomist. We'll see about that. But I'm really excited about it. We're going to be talking all over the place, but like existence of God stuff, what the heck is a hexaity, maybe univocity and analogy, primordial sin. It's all good stuff. I'm really excited to talk about it. Dr. Ward is a philosopher and, a historian now of Duns Scotus, which is awesome. So we're going to be all over the map. You're going to be an expert by the end of this, so stay tuned. Before we jump into the conversation, though, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon. If you guys like this podcast and you like what I do at all, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. You can join for like as little as $3 a month. Everything counts. If I had like 100,000 of you guys giving it at $3 a month, the production value would go up for sure. So something to consider. If you like this, you want to see me stick around, please consider becoming a Patreon patron. You can find the link in the description wherever you're getting this podcast at. All right, enough selling myself. Let's jump into the conversation with Dr. Tom Ward. Dr. Ward, thanks so much for coming on the podcast again, man. Third time.
Yeah, third time. I'm honored. It's great to see with you again, Parker.
I love being with you. I love hearing what you have to say. The only thing that is trepidatious for me, makes me fearful, is the stash, man. You always come on and you outdo me with the mustache, but a lot of my listeners are just listening, so they won't see that.
Well, if I could make a comment, I mean, it seems like yours has come a long way, as Parker's Pensies has progressed and developed into a major player in the Christian philosophy podcast world. That's awesome. Your mustache has come right alongside it. And actually, I was watching you in the intro just now, a question formed in my mind about how you trim it. And could I ask that question to you?
You could. It's really a simple answer. I just don't trim it.
You just don't trim it.
Yeah, so, I just play with it.
So you have like right in the center, it looks like you.
That's my Italian heritage.
Okay, so it just separates like that.
Yep. My brother's is even more like his, like that. It's like embarrassingly separated.
Yeah. So all of mine just goes straight down and then curls inward, actually. So
see, I want that. It's like the classic, you know, ladies with straight hair versus ladies with curled hair. They always want the opposite.
Okay.
Yeah. That's so good.
Well, I'm glad man. That important issue.
That's right. That's right. I told you earlier in a message that I'm not going to let this devolve into a conversation on fashion, but you got this amazing fashion sense, man, and you dress like a philosopher. And just so you know, some of us are watching you and seeking to emulate that style. So please keep it up.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind. Thanks. I'll try not to let people down too much.
Yeah. Thanks, man. It's important. Yeah. So you start this book off.
Wonderful waffle knit. Sort of blazer, double-breasted blazer sweater that I'm wearing right now, but it doesn't really come across in the in the video. But it's pretty nice. Yeah,
that's pretty slick. I'm gonna resist the temptation to follow that rabbit trail. This book. Let's get into John Duns Scotus. Man, so you start off the book by giving the story about a reviewer of one of your other books on Scotus. And they asked this question, you know, whether or not this whole project after reading the book, whether or not this project of interpreting him and laying out his arguments, like whether that's even worth it. And then you said you clipped that and put it up on your wall. And you said, you know, next time I write a book, I'm going to say, what does Scotus think? And then why should we care? I thought that was pretty. Is that a true story? You did that? You had it clipped up on your wall?
It's a true story. Yeah. Yeah. That review came out of the book and of my first book, you know, very technical book, not of general interest. And yeah. And the reviewer said that, and it just broke my little heart because I had worked so hard yeah. on that book. And it was even a fellow specialist who knew a lot about SCOTUS and wasn't a stranger to hard work thought, man, this is just really hard work. Is it worth it? Yeah, so I literally printed it out and had it taped above my desk as kind of motivation. Because on the one hand, it was there was the challenge aspect of it, like, hey, man, like, yes, it's worth it. Yeah. But then on the other hand, there was like I sensed, you know, there was some self-reproach, like, yeah, like I have been doing this, all this really technical stuff on SCOTUS. And if possible, I really would like to try to explain it to people who haven't been studying scholastic philosophy for years and years like I have, and try to say what's valuable about it. So yeah, the challenge, and that's what the book comes out of.
Yeah. Well, so this book is it's fascinating because it's even to take up this task is pretty daunting, that you're saying like, this is a book where if you are a SCOTUS scholar, you will get something out of it, but you don't have to be in order to get something out of it. And that's like this, you know, public facing philosophy that's so elusive that everyone's going after today. And I think you did a great job. If someone did read this book and said, well, I do want to get in more technical. What was that book that the reviewer was reviewing? The more technical one.
It's a book called John Duns Scotus on Parts, Wholes, and Hylomorphism.
That sounds good.
It was published by Brill in 2014.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
That's so good. Did that come out of your dissertation, or is that just?
Was my dissertation book. Awesome. I expanded it a little for the book, but yeah, it was essentially my dissertation.
Awesome. Fantastic, man. So I guess, like, you have these two questions in mind, you know, what does he think and why should anyone care? Was that like the impetus for writing this book, or was this like why write this book? When, why now, I guess.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Yeah. I actually started it a long time ago in 2013. So this was before the review that I mentioned even came out of my first book. So I was basically in this place where I had finished my PhD, I'd gotten my first tenure track job, and I was happy about all that, fulfilled in the sort of work I was doing, teaching and writing a few articles here and there, but also had this sense of you know, I'm now doing very weird, niche, philosophical, historical work. And not only does this not really register as important or interesting for the majority of my philosophy friends, but my family doesn't understand what I do. Most of my non-philosophy friends don't understand what I do. And even my philosophy friends don't understand what I do. So I should see if I could kind of sketch out a book that would make SCOTUS interesting to anyone who's kind of interested in philosophy, even if they don't have background. And I remember as a college student reading G.K. Chesterton's book on Aquinas.
And yeah, the Dumb Ox, right?
Dumb Ox, yeah. And then his, what's sometimes published together with it, his book on St. Francis. And both of those books were really inspiring to me and helped me catch that medieval bug that I, you know, still haven't got rid of.
Yeah.
And so I thought, yeah, if I could do a book kind of at that level on SCOTUS, you know, keep up with the technical work for my job, but then on the side, do this other thing. Yeah. So I got like two chapters written at that point way back then, and then had a table of contents, but basically just hit a ceiling where I realized that I just don't know enough yet to do this well. So I laid it aside. We come back to it every few years. And then during COVID, actually, I just had a lot of time on my hands and picked it up and finished it. And at that stage in 2020, it just kind of all came naturally. Though I imagined myself talking to students about SCOTUS as I was writing. And at that point, you know, I had enough experience by that point where it could all just come out in a non-scholarly way, you know, but still grounded in my own years of reading and thinking.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. And I was really excited by this because I would catch little glimpses of SCOTUS when I was in seminary. Sometimes the PhD students, you know, if they really wanted to sound smart, they would drop a SCOTUS line to Tom McCall in our Trinity class or something like that. And I'd be like, man, what, how do I get in on some SCOTUS stuff? I want to sound smart too. So I've really appreciated, this work, as an intro. And at the end, you give a bunch of, resources to follow up with if you want to study more. I wanted to get into like, So the PhD students who sounded super smart at TEDS would talk about the SCOTUS versus Aquinas beef and like the Dominicans versus the Franciscans. Can you just lay that out for us? Like what is this beef and like what the heck's going on?
Yeah. Nowadays it primarily has to do with this question about univocity versus analogy. Mm-hmm. One point I make in the book is that actually wasn't the original issue. Didn't seem like way back in the 13th century, it just wasn't a concern. I mean, there were already some fissures opening up between the Dominicans and Franciscans, but that particular issue, which gets so much play now, just wasn't really a concern. I think a more substantive issue would be like differences about the natural law and its relation to divine freedom. That tends to be an issue which really separates SCOTUSTs and Thomists. And I say it that way because I don't think there's quite as much separation between Aquinas and SCOTUS themselves on that issue. You know, SCOTUS representing the more voluntarist position, Aquinas representing a more non-voluntarist or sometimes called intellectualist tradition. I think the one nowadays is the univocity and analogy. I mean, really briefly, SCOTUS holds that at least some of our language and concepts by which we speak and think about God mean exactly the same thing or have exactly the same content as they have when we think or speak about creatures, as they have when as we think or speak about God. So univocity, the same one voice, so same meaning. In both contexts, or as analogy is supposed to be this kind of middle way where Aquinas says we, in order to reason deductively from the nature of creatures or the fact of the existence of creatures to the existence and nature of God, we've got to have stable meanings of terms. Otherwise, we commit the fallacy of equivocation, the fallacy of four terms. So we can't have that. But he says we can't have univocity either because our language and our way of thinking is specified to the structure of created being, and God doesn't have that structure. And so our words are bound to mean different things when we apply them to God. So analogy is this like middle way. On the one hand, we can still reason validly to God from creatures, but on the other hand, we are supposed to recognize this vast metaphysical difference between God and creatures in our semantics about religious language.
Yeah.
And So that topic, univocity versus analogy, really divides SCOTUS. Some people have described SCOTUS as idolatrous, or as flattening the gap between God and creatures. All of this crazy stuff that is really overblown. Because, I mean, think about the core conviction that Aquinas and SCOTUS share, namely that we can do natural theology in a deductive or quasi-deductive way. We can reason from the nature of created being to God. And both recognize that a condition on being able to do that is not to equivocate, to have mean, to have terms that mean not, you know, not the same thing, that that prejudice is the debate, but that have, call it, sufficient unity of meaning, stability of meaning, in order to reason validly. And and that core conviction to me is so much more important than whatever differences our theories end up having, or whatever differences in labels they give to their theories. And I do run an argument in the book that, as I read the texts, Aquinas, by the word univocity, means something different than SCOTUS by the word univocity. Univocal is not a univocal term, and I actually think there's a lot more similarity between the two than difference.
Yeah,
and I think that, you know, scholars who truck in this overblown rhetoric about univocity leading to idolatry or functional atheism is really irresponsible, and not just because it's false, but because it drives a wedge between Christian intellectuals when there needn't be one, you know, which isn't to say that, that they have exactly the same position, that there are no relevant differences at all, but it creates this sour spirit of debate, so that it's not constructive, but, you know, like the Thomists or the analogy supporters saving Christianity or you know, fighting for God against those evil
atheists. Like heretics or functional heretics. And it's really charged language, because it's like, dude, I thought we were talking about stuff that none of us really know, that we're trying to grasp at, and like, and now all of a sudden I'm a heretic. I side with the analogical, you know, predicators. But I did appreciate that in the book about univocal language. I think what you're saying is, like, you know, SCOTUS and Aquinas are both saying, like, we need to be able to speak literally about God. And Aquinas is like, well, you can speak literally and not univocally. And I think I hear it all the time in from my philosopher and my theologian friends. Most of my philosopher friends are like, analogy's out, dude, because you have to have some kind of univocal core. So let me just talk about that core, and I don't need the analogy. And all the theologians are like, we need the creator-creature distinction. And if you don't have that, if you don't have analogy, then you're shooting, you know, through the chasm to God or whatever. And so it still comes up all the time. And there's two Parkers that live in here that fight each other too. So it's tough, man. But I do appreciate you saying, like, this is not... This doesn't have to be as extreme. We probably don't need to burn each other at the stake for this one.
Yeah. I think that's right.
But it brings us to my next question about God's existence and being. SCOTUS runs, you know, an argument for God, and we're not going to get super into the details here. If you guys want, like, you need to go read the book for sure. It's a podcast. We can't always do all the nitty gritty stuff. But SCOTUS starts his natural theological argument for God with scripture, which is cool. I like that mode. It's maybe more like ramified natural theology or something, but starts with Exodus 3:14, I am that I am. That's what God says, you know, in response. And it seems like most of the medievals are saying, like, hey, that means that God is being itself. I wonder about, before we get into the argument and triple primacy stuff, I've always been confused about this idea, because it sounds like pantheism. Like, God is, right? Like, if he's being and I participate in being, then I am participating in God. And, like, what I am is made up of God, maybe, or something. You know, like, do you ever think about that? Do you ever worry about that? Is it weird?
Yeah, it is weird. It's a weird thing to say. And because they're all emphatic that the world is not a pantheistic world.
Yeah.
There's a difference between created being and an uncreated being. SCOTUS's preferred way of marking the difference is infinite being versus finite being. Mm-hmm. You know, Aquinas will talk about God as existence itself,
right,
and then everything else as having or sharing in like common being or something like that, you know, some sort of created being that has some sort of similarity to divine being, but is different. So yeah, there are different ways of marking the difference, but they all agree that there's this big creature creator gap. And so then what could it mean to say God is existence itself? Because I exist, I'm not God. So it looks like there's a part of existence that's not God's existence. And so what do they mean? I mean, I think for SCOTUS at least, is it's something like that there is in God something like an original exemplar of every possible way of existing. And he has this distinction between two ways of like having a ratio of, you know, a mode or aspect or way of being. He says that some of God's features he has formally, and so those would we would think of as the divine attributes, his goodness, wisdom, etc. And then others he has eminently. And it's quite mysterious exactly what that's supposed to mean. But God has somehow is the original exemplar of all the ways of being, like being a giraffe, or one of our examples from an earlier episode, like being a mustache.
Yeah,
it's all somehow in God or from eternity. But on SCOTUS's view, God has whatever formality, intelligible content there is to being a giraffe or being a mustache is in God in this most eminent way. And that's supposed to be something like he has that somehow, but we shouldn't say that we worship a mustachioed God or that God has a purple tongue. So the total existence that God is, according to SCOTUS, I think amounts to something like God's exemplarity, being the exemplar of any possible way of existence, rather than an identification of God with every single thing that exists.
Yeah. Okay. I've always, I don't want to be an idealist, and I don't know, like, I just don't think that's the right way to think about things. But anytime I think about God being existence himself or us existing in God, you know, all this language, I'm like, well, if we are divine ideas currently, then that would make a lot of sense. Like us being distinct, because maybe my thoughts are distinct from my substance, you know? Mm-hmm. So like I am not my thoughts, depending on who you ask, I guess. But that would be one way of making sense of it. But then I'm like, I don't know. Is that panentheism? You know, there's all sorts of like bombs to landmines to watch out for in this area. Yeah, it's wild. I don't know. Have you considered that at all? Are you allowed to consider that? I guess whether or not we are currently ideas in God's mind.
I mean, I think in theology, one of the things that most blows my mind is just the sheer fact of created being, and on several levels too, because if God is what Christians think God is, he's self-sufficient, three persons somehow enjoying this community or whatever. I'm not getting into the personalist versus classical theism debates here, but God has no need of anything and yet create. So that sort of like motivational aspect of creation, like why would God do such a thing?
Yeah.
And then secondly, what would that act be? That's just like, what would it be like to create? Because there's the ex nihilo issue, that's opaque to us, how you could make something out of nothing. And then also just like, what do you do to create, you know, the difference?
Yeah.
God thinks, say, I know this is too anthropomorphic, but, you know, God thinks, say, the world that he wants to make, and then decides, I'm going to make it. And so then what does God do next? Is it right. just like, and I have no, I can assign no, like, concepts to that, to answer that question. So it's utterly mysterious.
That's why, this is why I like analogy, because I'm like, well, we have authors today, and, you know, like J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, because I know that will stick with you because you mentioned Iluvatar and all your stuff. So like Tolkien created this world by his words, you know, he spoke and it was he with pen and paper, and in a non-univocal but perhaps analogical fashion, God created the world by his word. But you're still like, even with analogy, it's still like, what's the mechanism? You know, like, well, he spoke. And you're like, yeah, but I speak with air and vocal cords, and he doesn't have those. So, like, what are you saying? And you're like, dude, I don't know, man. It's an analogy. That's why it is what it is.
Yeah, and just to fully support the analogical thing in that context, you know, and just referring briefly back to the earlier part of the conversation, that's not the sense of analogy, I think, that's at issue when Aquinas and Scotus are talking about that. Like,
it's when we say God's good or God is love or something like that.
Yeah, the so-called, you know, attributes of God, where, or, you know, by virtue of divine simplicity in God, the divine attributes are identical with each other and with God himself, but we don't really know what that means because. Right. Wisdom is not altogether the same thing as power, etc. And so we're left with, like, how is it that we can say literally things about God when God is so different from us? So we access mysteries through analogies. It's not altogether like this, but it's somewhat like this, or it's a helpful way of getting at something that we otherwise could have no access to. And I don't think that when we call God wise or loving, we're reasoning like that. Like, we don't really know what God is, but if you think about, like, God is, if you think of God as having love, then maybe you, or being love, then maybe that's a way of accessing the reality that God is. When we say that God speaks into existence, or is like an artist, who creates, you know, I think that those are helpful analogies, but I do have a kind of half-baked view that where revelation, particular scripture, gives a kind of image of God or God's actions, that we should take that as the primary significant, and that and the rest as, you know, like merely creaturely acts of speaking, for example, like the things that are a little bit like God's act of speaking.
Right.
We understand these images better, so we access it that way. But God is the speaker, and then whatever we do is sort of like speaking.
That's so good. I love that. Because anytime my audience is sick of this, but I did write my master's thesis on the authorial analogy for God world relation. So I talk about it all the time. But when I would broach this with people, they would be like, well, you know, should we really be comparing the creator to the creature like this? And it's like, well, first of all, he did that, and we're made in his image. So if anything, Tolkien authors in a sub-creator way to the way that God authored the world, you know? So why not go that way, with the original to the derivative? Yeah.
I love it.
It's so good, man. Get me all fired up. Well, okay. So let's go back to existence stuff. If it's possible for anything to exist, it follows that God must exist, because God is existence itself. Like, can you help us with, like, Scotus's reasoning on his argument for God? We're not going to go into, like, probably existential quantifiers here, but yeah, just a broad sketch.
Yeah. I think a helpful way of introducing it is to compare it to two arguments that are probably a lot more familiar to people. Aquinas' first and second ways. So remember, the first way, it starts from motion or change. So some things are in motion, that is, some things undergo change. And then you reason from that contingent fact about the world to the existence of a prime mover unmoved. And then in the second way of Aquinas, we have the fact that something comes into existence, or something has come into existence, or has been efficiently caused. And then we reason from that contingent fact about the world that that there must be an efficient cause that itself, it doesn't have an efficient cause. So first cause, uncaused. And what SCOTUS does is he takes, one way to think about what he's doing is that he has that kind of cosmological approach. Those first and second ways are often described as cosmological arguments, as I know that you know. He takes that cosmological approach, but instead of starting with contingent premises about actually existing things, he starts with necessary premises about possibly existing things.
Yeah.
So, as you put it, something can come into existence, or possibly something begins to exist, or something like that. And then reasons from that necessary premise to the actual existence of something that by nature is able to produce something else, but cannot be produced by anything else. So if you have something that cannot be produced by anything else, but which is, so to speak, a necessary condition for the production of anything else, then it fails to exist, nothing exists. And yet, you know, but it at least can exist, right? That's the crucial premise for SCOTUS. So it, most things that can exist can also not exist. But if suppose that this nature, which by nature cannot be produced by anything else, suppose it didn't exist. Well, since nothing can cause its own existence and this thing can't be produced, then it couldn't exist. It would be impossible for it to exist. But it's possible for it to exist.
Yep.
So it exists.
Yeah.
So you get a kind of hybrid of a cosmological approach to God's existence with an ontological approach to God's existence. And SCOTUS actually explicitly acknowledges that he's touching up Anselm in the context in which he gives this argument. You know, he's seems to be deeply inspired both by not necessarily Aquinas's cosmological arguments, but Aristotle's arguments for first mover, combined with Anselm's arguments for you know, unnecessary being which nothing greater could be conceived.
So I think it just hit me as you were laying it out that it does have a kind of like transcendental nature, which is kind of fun, where it's like possibly something comes into existence. But what must be true in order for that possibility? Well, you have to have something else. And so you're reasoning almost, you know, transcendentally to the source. And then all you have to do is say like something, well, it's stronger than like starting with a banana and going backwards in a contingency argument. This is like possibly there's a banana. So you don't even need to point to a particular banana, though I could.
This is
even for the possibility. So even if bananas don't exist, that still presupposes this thing that you need to have bananas coming into existence, which is like super epic, man. That's so good.
Yeah. It's a really creative argument. It's original to SCOTUS, obviously drawing on aspects of earlier arguments. As far as I can tell, SCOTUS doesn't see his arguments as like supplanting other arguments or coming to the rescue of deficiencies in other arguments. Even his coloring Anselm, as he puts it, is not, it's just a minor tweak. So it's not like everything's wrong before. Yeah. And so now finally we can show that God exists. So it's just adding to the stock of good arguments. So it's original. It's really rigorous. I mean, much more rigorous than we've said here in the conversation or even that I give in the book. But then there's also this cool extra feature of it. So he starts with establishing what he calls the primacy of efficiency. So God is the first efficient cause. More correctly, or more technically for SCOTUS, God is the first thing able to produce an effect, because whether or not God efficiently caused anything, he would be able to produce an effect.
Right.
He's only an efficient cause if, in fact, he has. And he, in fact, has, so he is the efficient cause. But it's more important for the argument that God is the first thing able to produce an effect. So having, to his mind, established that God is the first in the order of efficiency, he then argues that there is a first in the order of final cause, causality, and then a first in what he calls the order of eminence. So basically an Anselmian perfect being, you know, that then nothing greater can be conceived. So the most eminent nature. So Run's arguments showing that there's the first in efficiency, the first in finality, the first in eminence, and then argues that only one nature can have all of these three things. And
they all refer to the same nature, the same.
They all refer to the same nature. Yeah.
So cool. I love that. Because then it's like, well, maybe we have three gods. Like, no, these all like co-refer.
Yeah. He calls this the triple primacy. So God has the triple primacy of efficiency, finality, and eminence.
So this part is really fun because, I mean, like famously, Aquinas is like, we can't prove the Trinity from reason alone. And it seems like SCOTUS is like, yeah, I agree. But here's some triple primacy stuff. And then he's like, well, divine love unites them all. Yeah. Right. So and it's like, well, is this an argument for the Trinity? Like, what
no.
Are you? Okay.
Oh.
That's good. Because they all co-refer to like the divine nature, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I've wondered the same thing, but I did finally come down on the side of a firm no. Okay. I don't think that's what he's doing on purpose. And I don't think that we should read that on to him.
Okay.
And that's because given the modal kind of aspect of the argument, what he's talking about is natures. So he'll say things like, there is a nature such that it can be produced, you know, therefore there is a nature such that it cannot be produced, but is the first thing able to produce an effect.
Yeah. So that can't be one person of the Trinity, because the other two wouldn't have that.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we're talking about natures, and one thing about Trinitarian theology and metaphysics is that we have exactly one nature shared by three persons. And so we don't want to have, you know, the most eminent thing be the spirit, blah, blah, blah.
So
don't go that way. But yeah. But
it's hard because we want threes. We see threes and we're like, dude, finally we got it. And like, no, don't do it. It's just maybe three is God's favorite number. And that's why, you know, you can prove them three times over.
Yeah. I don't know if you're acquainted with the theologian Fred Sanders.
Yeah.
He was a mentor of mine in college. And
oh, no way, dude. That's awesome.
Someone I have huge admiration for. But, you know, he does, this is like his shtick, you know, # also not like the Trinity.
Yeah, right.
all the standard examples, you know, the egg and the clover and all of that.
He's hilarious, by the way. People should follow him on social media. He's a really funny guy.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Oh, such a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
And so smart and clever. And
I just, when I think of him, I think of like he to me, he's like someone who's holding down the fort in Trinitarian thought, where he's like, not quite. Hey, not quite. Hey, don't do that. Yeah, yeah. I don't know a whole ton of his like constructive work. I mostly know like, no, don't do that, which is cool. We need people like that. But yeah, I'm sure he has other constructive work as well.
That's right. He does.
Yeah. Okay. So we've got the first efficient cause, the first final cause. Actually, I think I understand the, you know, first in perfection, the Anselmian way. I think I understand, you know, at least for the sake of our conversation, the first efficient cause. Help me with the first final cause. Does that have to do with like the chain of being, that God's like on top of the chain of being and all things are directed up at something? Or I'm not sure if I know that argument very well.
Yeah, it ends up there. Okay. So yeah, you're right to make that connection. So to be the first final cause in SCOTUS's lingo is to be that for the sake of which everything comes about.
Yeah.
And the basic idea here is that chains of final causality are transitive, just okay. like chains of efficient causality, and stand in as much need of a first as chains of efficient causality. So if you thought that if you were sympathetic with the no infinite regress premise
sure.
of cosmological arguments, then by SCOTUS's lights, you should be equally sympathetic with his premise that there can't be an infinite regress of
final causes,
final cause chains. So then the thought would be, well, maybe you could have final causal chains that really do terminate in firsts, but they're just a whole bunch of firsts.
Yeah, that's my next question. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, I think Aristotle thinks this in some sense. When he does his argument for the prime mover, of course he thinks that the intelligences that move the heavenly spheres that keep the earth kind of moving around and in being, that they do everything out of love for the first final the prime mover. And so in that yeah. sense, the prime mover for Aristotle is the first final cause.
Yeah.
That's actually how Aristotle's cosmological argument works. It has nothing yeah. to do with efficient causation. It has yeah. to do with final causation. But then at the same time, despite that fact about Aristotle, if you look at like the Nicomachean Ethics,
mm-hmm.
and in chapter one, in the book one, what we get is an account of the human good as happiness, and comments about like, you know, happiness has the sort of the right kind of nature or quality to terminate explanations of, you know, what we're doing.
Yeah.
And so then it would be like, well, there's your happiness and my happiness and so on and so forth. And so why is it that, why can't we just say that everything that I do is for the sake of my flourishing as an individual? So that terminates one final causal chain, mm-hmm. and likewise for you and then all the others. And I think here, this is going well beyond what SCOTUS yeah. himself says when he gives this argument, but in to maybe help people be sympathetic with this idea would be the thought that human happiness at least has this it's one thing to specify the state of a human being that is that state for the sake of which human willing or human action goes on. That's right. Another thing to describe the object in relation to which a human being would be in such a state.
Okay. You know?
And so in one sense, the final end of human action is God himself, because yeah. God is the good, is infinitely good, and so can satisfy all desire.
Yeah.
But then in another sense, the human end is happiness, because it is what we're trying to achieve,
yeah,
in our pursuit of God. So I mean, there you could see how the final causal, looked at in one way, the final causal chain that seems to terminate in my happiness actually terminates in
yeah
God.
I think that's really good. I thought maybe you were going to go a different route and say like, well, look, if everyone has their own happiness, then maybe we can't even talk about each other as being happy, because how do I know that your happiness is like my happiness? So that I think there might be another way to run it too, and say like, no, like we, this is the problem of nominalism or of going in for tropes or something like that. Like you there's got to be something that unifies this happiness in order for us to actually like predicate it of each other. And so there needs to be something here, and that can't be the final form because it is directed at God too. Or I think there's other ways to mess around with that. That's fun.
Yeah. And then another kind of wrinkle to this that's quite different from what we've just been saying is that SCOTUS does have a view about final causality where it only intelligent agents can let me back up actually. So he says this weird thing about final causes that seems to require that there is only final causality where there is intelligence. So here's what he says, that, you know, the final cause you might think is like the end that something is pursuing. And SCOTUS actually tries to make a distinction between the end as what something aims at and the end as a final cause.
Mm.
And the reason he gives is that to be a cause, an end has to be prior to the to what it causes.
Yeah. Okay. That seems intuitive.
Yeah. So then, you know, we say that the end of an acorn is to become flourishing oak tree. It's like, okay. Yeah. SCOTUS would say, yes, you know, he's a good Aristotelian. Things really do act for the sake of ends. But what he'll say is that just because the acorn is, you know, ordered by its nature to grow into a flourishing oak tree, that doesn't entail that, you know, something like the oak tree or the completed oak tree is a cause of the acorn's activity, developmental activity. So in order for that end oak tree to be a cause of the acorn's existence and characteristic life activity, the oak tree has to be cognized by some agent who acts to bring about the acorn, at least in part, for the sake of the oak tree.
Yeah.
So in SCOTUS's lingo, it is the end insofar as it is loved that is the final cause of whatever is finally caused.
Yeah. They really like, the medievals really like using love in all these ways.
Yeah.
That they were like, what the heck? But it's like, yeah, but you say you love a taco. So maybe don't, you know, maybe don't hammer the medievals for their use of love too much. I think that this acorn and oak tree thing makes a lot of sense. Maybe I'm totally getting it wrong, but it's like, man, how could this tree be the final, the full oak tree be the final cause of this acorn if it doesn't exist yet? Maybe if you go in for like B theory of time and say, is there in the future drawing, you know, that's like backward causation or something. But instead it's like, no, like the form of the tree is what drives it there. And like you have a lover, an admirer, an intelligence that is shaping it towards that idea of it as a complete tree.
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, that's awesome. I like that. Yeah. That's really cool. All right. So we have this triple primacy. Everyone's got to grab the book for that alone. Like that's super fantastic. Maybe don't say that's an argument for the Trinity. You kind of hint at it. That's what like some of my favorite like theologians on the Reform side of things, John Frame, will just be like, there's three here and God's three. And so, you know, that's good enough. Maybe don't make the connection too much. But I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, foist this onto my listeners, this idea of hexaity. And I pronounce my podcast Parker's Pensies. I do it intentionally because I don't want to sound like, you know, sound like the middle-aged lady saying gracias at the Spanish restaurant and being just embarrassing herself. I don't speak French, so I don't try to do it. I'm an American swine. However, the one thing that made me think maybe I should say pensées and try to pronounce it is I heard Steven Pinker on a podcast once, and he goes, you know, the medievals thought, you know, they had this idea of a hecate. And I was like, no, what? And I was like, dude, now I understand the French speakers listening and how much they must hate my pronunciation. So it's a hexaity. It's not that hard. It's close. Maybe I'm, but at least I'm not saying hecate, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I think, did you say this was Thomas Pink?
Steven Pinker.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in terms of just the Latin, that's perfectly fine.
Oh, and no.
Maybe
you can say hecate.
Correct.
Oh, that's horrible. Not,
I wouldn't say heckity, but in terms of like if you were reading the Latin word,
okay,
hecaitas, I think would probably be the most accurate way of
okay.
of pronouncing the Latin.
Yeah.
So then our word hecaity, like yeah. that's an English word. It's
right.
it's like transliterated from the Latin. But so then what I my view is that despite the fact that hecaity or something like that would be would reflect Latin pronunciation better than hexaity.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, hexaity is an English word,
yeah.
and the most common way to pronounce that word is hexaity.
Okay.
Not any other pronunciation, and so there's like an argument. It's sort of an argument from custom or convention. Like this is the
yeah.
convention to be established. We should stick to it.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, maybe there's like a circle of users of that word who yeah. consistently say hecaity.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like the Augustine.
Yeah, well, we've solved that one on the podcast. Augustine is in Florida. Augustine is in heaven.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. That's good.
Let's hecaity.
Yeah, what the heck is this? Thing
yeah
this-ness. Yeah
yeah it's you know sometimes thought of as I think something basically like a bare particular in
oh sweet I was gonna ask you about that yeah
but it's not that.
Oh, okay
well let me say what it is
yeah.
So the medieval scholasticism had this this interesting debate. Aquinas weighed in on it. Pretty much everyone weighed in on it. What is the principle of individuation?
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is something like this. Like, suppose you're some sort of a realist about universals. So you mm-hmm. say, all right, there's such a thing as human nature. There's such a thing as being 6 feet tall. There's such a thing as having brown hair, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All of these are shareable features, like
yeah.
things that things can hold in common. So if you're a realist about these features, then when you have an individual bearer of those features,
mm-hmm.
There's got to be something explanatorily prior to all of those shareable things, in virtue of which that bearer is one individual thing.
Right.
So if you are a realist, whether an extreme realist or moderate realist or whatever brand flavor,
yeah. Yeah.
you have to have a principle of individuation.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a nominalist, you don't have that problem. You just say, well, I don't need to explain what individuates things because things don't come any other way but individuated.
Yeah. They have the converse problem of like, well, then what are properties and how do I share the same property? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So Scotus is on the realist side of this, as almost everyone was until Occam, and then there was a little bit more of a free for all. But
yeah.
some form of realism was still ascendant for a long, long time.
Mm.
And so the idea is this: Aquinas offered probably the most well-known principle of individuation. He said it was matter,
yeah.
and in particular, matter. Materia signata, matter signed or designated by quantity, dimensive quantity. So you have something like a chunk of matter.
Yeah.
And that is what individuates this particular human being who is 6 feet tall and brown haired.
Is it a chunk of, I don't know Aquinas super well. Did he go in for like prime matter? Was it a chunk
yeah.
of prime matter, and once it's like individuated, it's not prime matter anymore because it's particularized or something.
Yeah, so there would be a distinction between prime matter, materia prima, and materia signata. You know, it's
okay.
like prime matter designated by, signed by.
Gotcha.
You know, if you think about a signet ring,
yep.
like you have the wax and then it's signated by
so
the
good.
Ring.
The yeah, wax is so prime matter. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Aquinas's view was criticized on several fronts, including by Scotus. And I think the best criticism is that on the broadly Aristotelian ontology that they both accepted, quantity was considered a way of being a substance. And so so the existence of a substance is at least explanatorily prior to the quantity of the substance, the okay. quantitative dimension or shape that the substance is or has.
Okay.
And so it can't serve to individuate, because as a kind of accidental form, quantity is ontologically dependent on substance.
So, and you still need to individuate that substance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. That's exactly. Good.
So yeah. It arrives too late on the scene, explanatory yeah. scene, to be an individuating principle.
Okay.
There were other views too. Like one was like to say that what individuates things is purely negative. Like to be individual is to be,
not something else.
Not something, yeah, distinct from, yeah, not something.
That one's so
Scotus criticized all of these. And that what he came up with is that, one, the principle of individuation has to be ontologically positive. It can't be a negation or a privation. It has to be a positive thing in order to do the explanatory work of individuating. And it has to be, has to have the right kind of priority to the substance itself that it individuates.
Okay.
So he came up with this idea of thisness. That's literally what hekeitas means, or hekseitas.
Yeah.
It literally means thisness. And so the idea is that, say, there's Parker's human nature, Parker's particular shape and size, and et cetera.
Yeah.
And then there is Parkerness.
Yeah.
Which is something analogous to a form, but okay. it is different from a form precisely in that it is not shareable or repeatable.
Yeah.
So you can't have many Parkers, and you can't have something, that, like, now you have Parkerness, but then, maybe you die and then Parkerness becomes something that something else might have.
Right.
Nope. If whatever has Parkerness is Parker.
So even my clone, my identical clone, does not have my quiddity.
That's right.
Your clone. Oh yeah. Sorry. Yeah. I meant to bring in quiddity, because I don't understand quiddity either.
Whatness. But. Whatness. So you have, so the quiditas, what?
Yeah.
Hexeitas, this. So, what is it? There you're asking the question about, the metaphysical question that's, to what kind does it belong?
So does quiddity pick out, like, my humanity?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, yeah. But I'm a particularized humanity, a hexeitas.
Yeah. Yeah, humanity, an individual human substance made individual by your Parkerness, your hexeity. Gotcha. Yeah.
That's good. That's really good.
Yeah.
I love these words. I want to bring them back. So
cool words. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So here's an easy way to misunderstand hexeity, because it's because I'd kind of like it to be true. So so the thought is that you are, like, this hexeity is not this bare particular that all of your features are contingently attached to.
Okay.
it's not as though we could ask the question, could Parker be a frog?
Mm-hmm.
And in order for Parker to be a frog, given that you're a human now, you would have to, lose your humanity and gain your frogginess, and gain frogginess.
Yeah.
And if you were thinking of hexeity just as like a pincushion, then you think, well, what would be the problem with that? You would need a weird kind of explanation to show why some of the pins in the pincushion can't be pulled out. Like having a mustache pin, that can be pulled out, but having a human pin, that can't be. That would just be weird. So, don't think of hexeity as a bare particular or metaphysical pincushion.
That's a really good analogy. That so the bear particular would be the pincushion, and I just have all these pins in here and they're all red. But why can't I switch out all these red pins with green pins? Because if it's a bear particular, it seems like it just, yeah, that survives the transfer of all of these properties.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah. And that's not what SCOTUS has in mind here right. at all. Instead, he thinks that your Parkerness is individuating a human nature.
Yeah.
So it's like you are essentially the particular human you are mm-hmm. because of Parkerness. Now, like, so your humanity is shared by all, but the particular humanity that you are, or the particular human being you are, is due to, so to speak, the contraction of humanity plus Parkerness.
I'm wondering if this bringing in the more modern conversation, if this like commits us to like origin essentialism or something, like is my parents, is that part of my Parkerness, or what do you make of that?
I don't think so. Cool. I don't think that SCOTUS thinks this okay. about pretty much anything. But it's a difficult issue. I'm not going to get into the weeds on it, but SCOTUS has going a little bit back to the argument for a first in the order of efficiency. Uh-huh. What SCOTUS is trying to do in that argument is to say that by their very natures, mm-hmm. everything that can come into existence has this essential order to God.
Yeah. Right?
It's like built into our natures that we can only exist insofar as we have some causal connection to the first in the order of efficiency.
Okay.
So there you think, okay, that's a kind of essentiality of origin.
Yeah.
But so then you ask, well, what else? Like, is there anything else that is sort of baked into our natures such that we can only come about insofar as we're in a causal chain with that thing in addition to God? And there, like, I've put that question to SCOTUS really hard. And,
yeah.
And he just doesn't say anything. No, I haven't found an answer. That's good. I haven't found a good answer. So one worry that I have is that, like, gosh, it, like, maybe we have no essential order to anything except for God. And so to then it's just like free for all. Yeah. Could God have created you ex nihilo, like all by yourself, you know, maybe in a nice park or something so that you could breathe air and have grass to run around in? Like, need you have had human parents at all? I don't think so for SCOTUS, let alone need you have had the very parents that you have. So yeah, I think probably SCOTUS is at least committed to a strong denial of the essentiality of origin, except of course for God.
Yeah.
But that's a hard issue.
Yeah. And you could say that, like, well, technically speaking, that's possible, but like, if you wanted to create me, being someone who could have this conversation on this podcast right now, then no, I would need to have this. So it's like a contingent type thing.
When we're thinking about ourselves as, you know, like we often talk about our identity, not in a strictly metaphysical sense, but in something like my personality, my background, my character.
Right.
Then like, in that much more contingent way, we could say, yeah, it's hard to imagine someone with this identity in that sense, having a, like, maybe you could slightly tweak the origin story, but not much before you start getting a very different sort of person.
Yeah. And I always think of this all in light of the authorial analogy for the God world relation, and thinking about, like, God had me in mind prior to the story, or did he, you know? And now we got superlapsarianism, infralapsarian. It's fascinating when you start like getting into this stuff. I love it. It's so exciting for me. I got one more question for you, but actually maybe like a half question before that. I posed this to one of your colleagues, Dr. Robert Garcia, about his theory of tropes and NFTs. non-fungible tokens, which aren't, you know, now it seems like it's a huge scam, and it was more fun to talk about it back then. Now maybe I'm perpetuating a scam or something like that. Sorry, folks. But it seems like a hexadey, like an NFT, is like maybe a decent way of thinking through like a hexadey. Like, it's a non-fungible token. There's only one of these things. It's like, it is unique insofar as that's what NFTs are. What, have you thought about that? Is that, does that sound right?
Yes, it does sound right. And I like the qualification insofar as that's what NFTs right. are. Because that lets me say, yeah, that sounds right. Okay. Because I actually don't understand an NFT and the, okay. I haven't looked into it. Yeah. People talk about it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't know that very many people do understand them. Okay. So I think yeah. we're both safe in that.
I'm definitely out of my depth here yeah, when it comes yeah. to NFTs, but yeah. So if that's what an NFT is, then yeah, that does sound right.
That's pretty cool. So I say that in hopes of being, of doing some more like public facing philosophy stuff where it's like that. That's what some of the abstract thinkers who are non-philosophers are talking about. I'm like, hey, have you heard of hexadeities? Nice. No, not Steven Pinker's pronunciation, but hexadeity, and like luring them into philosophy and theology. I wanted to end. Man, this might be the wrong one, and you can just pass if you want to. But just talking about like, so thinking of the authorial analogy, God made the world. We have this explanation even for Adam and Eve's sin because the serpent was there tempting them. But what about the serpent? What about primordial sin? I think, if I've read this right, Duns Scotus follows Anselm in giving this qualification between two types of affections. Can you help us figure that one out real quick? Just maybe enough to give people a taste that they can go buy the book.
Yeah, this is awesome. I just love this two wills or two affections theory of the will.
Yeah,
and yeah, you're right. Scotus gets it from Anselm, and Anselm develops this understanding of the will in the context of like angelic sin. Like, yeah, just as you put it, how do we explain Lucifer's sin or the serpent's sin or being sinful? So the idea is, I'll try to be brief, but think about what you might think of as like a broadly Aristotelian or roughly Aristotelian way of thinking about human action, that we, like, everything we do is in some sense or other aimed at our happiness, you know, mm-hmm. happiness considered as eudaimonia, flourishing, not mere hedonism or whatever. But
yeah,
so we're always happiness aimers. In some sense, looking out for our own good. What Anselm does, and Scotus follows him, is to imagine like an angelic being like Lucifer, with a will like that, a happiness maximizing will. And so imagine Lucifer like recognizing, like, gosh, God made me really great and I'm grateful for that, but God could make me even greater than I am. Mm. Like, I'd be more powerful, more intelligent. I'd have more honor. I'd be happier. I want that higher status that mm-hmm. God could give me, but has not so far.
Yeah,
so that could be a, you know, possible object of Lucifer's will. Now, if he were a happiness maximizer, he could do something like, he could think something like this. I want that thing, that higher status, let's call it. God could give it to me, but God has not. He could think all of that, presumably non-sinfully, but like there's nothing, doesn't seem to be anything wrong with just thinking all of those things, like recognizing those truths.
Right.
But now suppose he wills, like, I want to be that, my will is committed in that direction.
Yeah.
And even if I recognize that it's not possible for me to do anything about it, to give me that higher status, like the fact that I can't get there is going to be a cause of sadness or bitterness or something like that. So his will is just sort of all in on having that higher status.
Yeah.
And that seems at first like that should be wrong, you know, for Lucifer to be upset at God for not having that status, for Lucifer to be committed to achieving that status, if there's anything that he can do about it. Like all of those things would seem to be wrong, but Anselm says they can't be wrong if all there is to Anselm's will is to pursue his own happiness, because all that Lucifer is really wanting there is to be as happy as he could possibly be. Mm-hmm. So he would be not morally responsible for wanting this higher status that he has.
Yeah.
All right. So what Anselm does is he says that native to Lucifer's will, and also to every created will, is not only this inclination toward our own happiness, but also an inclination toward what is just. Mm-hmm. And these can coincide, but they need not coincide.
Yeah.
So in the case of the higher status that Lucifer would want just by his affection for his own advantage, Lucifer can also recognize that God is to be obeyed, to be loved above all things. God hasn't granted that status. And so he should just be okay with that. Yeah. So that, in that sense, that inclination for justice, like in this case, respecting God's wishes, puts a sort of cap or check on the affection for advantage. So what Anselm ends up doing here is giving us a whole theory of the will's freedom and moral responsibility that is grounded in these two affections, which are by nature ordered to different formal objects. And then freedom consists in the affection for advantages, power to like prevent us from just slavishly always going toward what the happiness dictate says we should go for.
Yeah.
So we can, so to speak, like hold ourselves back and say, wait, is that really the thing to be done? Mm-hmm. Because of my affection for advantage, I have freedom here. I don't have to go for what seems to be most happiness promoting.
Yeah.
So then you explain the fall, Lucifer's fall, by he has these two affections. So he's responsible for correctly using his affection for advantage to make sure that he's willing happiness within the limits of justice. Mm-hmm. And he chooses not to.
Yeah.
So now he's morally responsible for seeking that higher status that he wasn't supposed to seek. And that's what the fall, Lucifer's fall, consists in. So it's a way of showing how a will that originally is uncorrupted by any sin could start going wrong.
Yeah.
Like you always, just by nature, your happiness drive, advantage drive, just is ordered for its own advantage.
Yeah.
And the justice drive is ordered toward justice, and we can go either way.
Do we need libertarian free will? You know, is there a principle of alternate possibilities at play there, or is this also compatible with a compatibilist take?
I think that Anselm is a libertarian.
Yeah, I think you're right. No, I think you're right on that.
Notices too. Could we tweak it?
Because you probably need there to be like 50-50 or whatever. You need like some indeterminacy probably in order to say like, this is why he chose. Well, it's not really an explanation of why he chose affectio commodi instead of iuvitat, whatever the Latin is, justice. Yeah. You probably need that. Otherwise, you're saying, well, no, it looks like God still gave him the desire to choose advantageous over. No matter what, it's like God still has to have some kind of greater reason for it, you know, like whether libertarian free will is a greater good, or whether having Satan in the grand story allows for, you know, incarnation and redemption. You know, we're still going to have that in there. But I'm just, it's fun to think through, like, can we mix and match these things, even though I'm pretty sure Anselm would have been a libertarian. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a really compelling. I really like the analysis done, because sometimes, like, I really love C.S. Lewis, but I think Lewis, when talking about angelic sin, says like, "Hey, sometimes people fall off their bikes for no reason." And it's like, yeah. That's not super satisfying, Clive. You know, like, but this might be just a further explication of how it is that someone might fall off their bike willfully.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, this has been so good. Thanks so much. I'm like, I have to read this again probably. And there's so many things that you've opened up for me. That idea about, like, perhaps a transcendental argument in SCOTUS is really getting my gears turning. The book's fantastic. We only covered a couple of chapters. So folks at home, like, you got to grab the book for more. There's stuff about living virtuous life. I guess SCOTUS is like responsible for the Immaculate Conception. So if you're a Protestant, you're like, this guy, you know, but if you're a Catholic, you're like, hey, this guy, great. There's a lot in there.
Yeah. Real quick on that. You know, I'm a Catholic. And so I was, you know, I write sympathetically about SCOTUS's treatment, but, you know, I come from a Protestant background, tons of Protestant friends. And so I was also thinking, like, what would be the way to present the doctrine in a way that would be, like, least alarming to a Protestant? And I think the way to do that, it would be to show as much as possible why SCOTUS thinks that this doctrine is actually honoring of God and Christ in particular. And Catholics, because they get so excited about Mary, don't always make those connections, even though it's, like, baked into the theology. I don't think I've said enough probably to convince any Protestant, but maybe a Protestant could read it and say, okay, hey, they're still wrong, but at least they're thinking of Jesus.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's really good. This is a hot topic right now. I try not to let anything be too, like, culturally relevant so that my stuff can be evergreen. But the listeners will know that this is a hot topic right now in certain circles in which I run. Okay. So, yeah, man, this is awesome. Again, the book is Ordered by Love, An Introduction to John Duns Scotus by Dr. Thomas M. Ward. And it's out right now, right?
Yeah, it came out last month. Okay. Yeah, it's there. Can I also briefly say, you mentioned how stoked you are on SCOTUS's argument for God's existence.
Yeah.
I should say that next year, Hackett is publishing my translation of SCOTUS's treatise, De Primo Principio, treatise on the first principle, where he lays all this out. And then Hackett's also letting me publish a commentary alongside of it. So in the same volume.
So dude, it's, like, you gotta come back on. That's
30,000 words of hardcore natural theology, followed by as many words from me trying to unpack it all and say, you know, what it might mean. It's a really hard text, but I think super rich. And
is that finished? Is that already in production?
Yeah.
It will be out. It's coming out.
Awesome. Yeah. So I can't wait for that. So since Hackett is publishing, it should actually be affordable. So
yeah, that's even better.
Put that out there. Keep an eye out for that.
Awesome, man. Can you tell the audience where they can find your like blogs and stuff?
Yeah, well, actually, I've recently taken the blog down, but go to my website, thomasmward.com, and then there's, you know, links to a lot of stuff there.
Awesome. Yeah. All right. I'll leave a link in the description to that and a link to Ordered by Love. If you grab that from mine, you will be supporting the podcast through my affiliate link. So check that out. That's going to have to do it for now, folks. This has been awesome. That's it. This has been Parker's Pensies. And as always, all glory to God.